I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views, we continue our international coverage of the coronavirus pandemic, this time with a perspective from Brazil. Joining us on this edition of the program is Brian Mir of the Brazil Wire to discuss not only the pandemic situation as it is in Brazil, but also a little bit of recent Brazilian political history, namely the ouster of former President Lula da Silva, and also the current extreme right-wing regime gripping Brazil under President Bolsonaro, who is becoming extremely isolated as the coronavirus crisis worsens in his country. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now, on to our conversation with Brian Mir of the Brazil Wire. Welcome to Parallax Views, co-founder of Brazil Wire, Brian Mir. How are you doing today? You're right in Brazil right now as we speak. What is going on there?
Well, I'm just basically in quarantine. I had thanks for having me on, by the way. I had pneumonia in February, which now in hindsight looks like it might have been coronavirus. And the doctor told me not to go out on the street because I have a residual cough. And if people hear me coughing on the street with a kind of coughing attack, I might get beaten up by an angry mob. And I thought he was joking. I posted something on my Facebook about this, and like three different friends of mine living here in São Paulo said they've already seen this happen.
Wow. It sounds like the situation there is intense. We're going to get into coronavirus, the pandemic in Brazil and what it's been like there. But first, I want to talk a little bit about Brazil Wire for my listeners that may be unfamiliar with it. I know that I believe you helped co-found it along with Daniel Hunt, I believe, who is also a member of one of my favorite bands, Ladytron. But I think it's a really great website.
Well, yeah, I'm not a founding editor. The other founder with Dan was a guy named Craig Luis, who's back in living in London now. Hasn't done much for the Brazil Wire in a couple of years. I came on at around 2015. At that time, I was writing for the Center for Economic and Policy Research's America's blog, and I was writing for COHA and doing some occasional articles for NACLA. But I just really liked, like, what happened is someone sent me an article that Dan had written, and he doesn't usually put his name on stuff. And someone asked me if I was the one who wrote it. And I read it, and it looked like something that was written by me so much that I immediately got in touch with them. And I've been writing for them since 2015. I'm now co-editor with Dan.
I'm sorry I got that wrong. I didn't realize you weren't a co-founder. You're so tied to Brazil Wire, I guess I maybe just connected you in my mind to it.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, it makes, I've been doing a lot of the, most of the writing, maybe 60, 70% of the writing for the last 3 or 4 years. So I can see why, you know, people would think that. But anyway, it's a labor of love. We don't get paid for it, which on the one hand, it's kind of annoying, but on the other hand, we're not influenced by anybody. So like, we're free to say whatever we want. And I think in hindsight, it's much better that we never got any kind of funding, you know, or advertising or anything like that during the entire coup period and Lula's political imprisonment and the rise of Bolsonaro, because the entire time we've just been saying exactly what we think and exactly what we believe is happening without pulling any punches, including a lot of stuff about U.S. involvement in the whole process and the role that U.S. media has played in it.
I want to note, too, I believe you've been in Brazil for quite some time now, at least since around the turn of the century, I believe. That's what I heard in the Last Born in the Wilderness podcast that you did recently with Patrick Farnsworth, right?
Well, I lived in Brazil from 91 to 95, and then I came back to the U.S., finished my bachelor's degree, got a master's degree, and moved back to Brazil in December 99, and I've been here ever since. So total, probably about 25 years.
I just wanted to note that because I think it gives you a real expertise in the area. You have a sort of understanding of the politics and what is going on in Brazil, which sort of leads me to the precursor period to coronavirus in Brazil. Namely, you mentioned Lula, and I may have listeners that are just tuning in and just learning about international politics. So who was Lula and what was the coup, and who is Bolsonaro?
Okay. Well, in short, Lula is one of the greatest labor union organizers of the last like 50 or 60 years. During the latter period of the military dictatorship, he came up through the machine shop floor in a metal workers, a steel foundry in the industrial suburbs of São Paulo called the ABC region, which is just this huge region of factories, population of about 3 million. He had a fourth grade education. He was from a very poor family, grew up in a wooden shack, and he was just a brilliant labor union organizer. So in 79, he led this wildcat strike of the steel workers and the metallurgical workers that went national, and it was the first nail in the coffin of the military dictatorship. They tried to arrest him. They put him in jail for a couple weeks, but there's too much pressure. They had to release him, you know, and at this point, together with so basically because of his action and the action of the comrades he was working with and everything, a new kind of labor union was invented. I mean, social science researchers and stuff created a term to describe the CUT, which is the Labor Union Federation, National Labor Union Federation, which is the second largest federation of unions in the Western Hemisphere after the AFL-CIO. That Lula founded, and they compare it with what is it called in South Africa? Mine's drawing a blank now, but they call this social movement unions, social movement unionism, in that the unions fight for the general good of society and not just for their own interest in raising wages and things like that. And so together with the CUT, which is the union federation he founded, they linked up with social movements, a lot of which were coming out of organizing work done by liberation theology priests and nuns during the dictatorship, because they were some of the only people who were allowed to organize. You know, the dictatorship was like torturing and killing union activists and others, like social movements, student unions and things like that were all outlawed, but they let the church continue. And so this coalition of social movements like the MST, labor unions, coalesced together and created the PT party. And, you know, over the years, Lula ran for president like four times. Finally, after the final time he was running for president, he realized that they were not going to take power unless they swung towards the center a little bit. So he wrote a letter called My Letter to the Brazilian People, 6 months before the election season began, explaining that in order for the PT to take power, he had to make some concessions to international capital. And he flew up to the Bretton Woods institutions in Washington and visited IMF and World Bank and promised not to default on the loans. And kind of like with the begrudging approval of these institutions, he was able to take power. And a lot of people say, oh, he talked left and walked to the right. No, he explained to everybody what he had to do, you know. And so as soon as he took power, he implemented a massive minimum wage increase policy. When he took office, Brazil's minimum salary in dollar terms was $49 a month. When he left office, it was over $300 a month. And this, the neoliberals like to talk about this welfare program he set up called Bolsa Família. But the biggest studies that were done on why 30 million people rose above the poverty line during his and Dilma Rousseff's presidency was the minimum wage increases. You know, and they locked pension funds into minimum wage too. And they opened up pension, the kind of Brazilian equivalent of Social Security, to rural workers who didn't have legal employment. You know, they weren't officially employed. They're like farmhands working for cash. They were eligible for retirement. And so this really like transformed Brazilian society. And so instead of defaulting on the IMF loans, he got together with Nestor Kirchner, and Argentina and Brazil paid back their loans early on the same day. And the next day, the IMF had to lay off 2,000 employees. They were furious. They lost so much money because Lula was it, because they paid the loans back early. And then once they were freed up from the IMF conditionalities, he swung the government to the left. And it worked. He kept Brazil out of the 2008 subprime mortgage crisis. It had like one quarter of negative 0.2 fallen GDP, which compared to all the other countries was much better. And so Brazil passed up England in terms of largest economies in the world. And they were really pissed off about that. And so he left office with 89% popularity rating.
I believe he I didn't mean to interrupt. I was going to say, I believe he also had public health care reforms.
Yeah, I mean, spending on health and education was increased dramatically. He opened up 21 new free public university campuses and something like three new public universities, including one which was specifically made for African exchange students in Bahia to reach out to the Portuguese diaspora in Africa, filling it up with students from Guinea-Bissau, from Mozambique and Angola, you know? And he started, all kinds. I mean, I could go on and on about the stuff he did, but a lot of it was really impressive. Like one of the things the PT did was they established the most ambitious affirmative action program in history, which is that they basically said the population of Brazil is 51% Afro-Brazilian, you know, and the vast majority of Afro-Brazilians are in the working class. And so we're going to guarantee 51% of all public university slots for people from the working class who've gone to public grammar school and high school with a differential on the entrance exam for Afro-Brazilians. And at the time that this program started, only 2% of the public university students in the country were Afro-Brazilian. And like they've achieved equity now because of this. Bolsonaro hasn't even managed to cancel the program yet. So there's all kinds of examples of really... I mean, they passed a law requiring all public schools and hospitals in rural areas to buy 100% of the food for their school meals from family farmers, so that when the PT left office, 70% of the food consumed in Brazil was still produced by family farmers, not agribusiness corporations. And I mean, there's all kinds of interesting stuff they did, but at the same time, you know, you can criticize a lot of the stuff they did too. It wasn't like a Valhalla. He kind of like, first of all, he maintained this neoliberal policy, macroeconomic policy tripod of his predecessor of high interest rates. They lowered them, you know, considerably, but they were still among the highest in the world when Dilma Rousseff left office. High interest rates and an independent central bank, you know, and floating exchange rate or whatever. But anyway, just to continue with the health, when Dilma Rousseff took over, after Lula left office. She did some pretty impressive things with public health. First of all, they did a study and they found that the real problem with the health system was not lack of doctors or lack of money. It was that most doctors in Brazil are upper class, upper middle class, and they want to live in the big important cities like Rio de Janeiro, São Paulo, whatever. Like they couldn't. The problem was that there was an excess of doctors in the big cities and no one was willing to go to rural areas or work in slums. And so Dilma Rousseff started a program through the Pan American Health Organization in partnership with Cuba, where she opened up all of the job offers in all the rural areas for Brazilians first. And in cases when Brazilians wouldn't apply for the job, she brought in Cuban doctors. And she brought in, like, over the course of her presidency, 11,000. When Bolsonaro took power, there were still 8,000 Cuban doctors working in Brazil. And Cuban doctors are incredible. You know, because they're used to working in systems that don't have a lot of equipment, a lot of money, and they take a lot of time listening to the patients and trying to find out what the homeopathic, the other problems in their lives are and things like that, so they can treat the root of the problem. And so when Bolsonaro took office, there were 8,000 of them. He immediately fired them all for ideological reasons and sent them back to Cuba. So now with the coronavirus crisis breaking, there's 33 million Brazilians living in areas, in rural areas, that have no doctors at all, right? Because he was unable to fill those positions. And recently, his government started trying to invite them back. Okay, and the other thing she did was the state petroleum company, Petrobras, which is like 50-something percent state-owned and 40-something percent private stockholders or whatever, she issued a decree allocating all of the profits from Petrobras to be divided between the public health system and the public education system. And one of the first things that happened after the 2016 coup was Michel Temer canceled that. And then they passed a constitutional amendment freezing public health spending for 20 years, even though the population is growing. So it's really equivalent to like cutting public health spending. And those two things have really like fucked Brazil over to face this crisis right now, you know? So I know I'm jumping back and forth and getting ahead of myself. You wanted to know about the coup?
Yeah, the coup, and I want to note real quick, Lula was imprisoned, I believe, okay, from November 8th, 2019, and then released 580 days later. He was basically put in jail. I mean, there was a coup, more or less.
Yeah, there was a coup. There was the coup that removed Dilma Rousseff from office, which you can see about in this great movie, The Edge of Democracy. And another really good documentary that wasn't nominated for an Oscar but got a standing ovation in the Berlin Film Festival, which is called The Process. There are two really good documentaries about this. And if you're interested in what happened in 2016, I recommend watching those. Edge of Democracy is on Netflix, I think. And Lula's imprisonment, right? Like, it was a lawfare attack against Lula, led by the U.S. Department of Justice, really, and in partnership with these far right wing public prosecutors in Curitiba. And whenever you start defending someone who is arrested ostensibly for corruption or whatever, you can be accused of being an apologist for corrupt politicians or something like that. But literally, he was thrown in jail after being convicted of committing indeterminate acts of corruption. In other words, the prosecutors could not put their finger down on any single crime he'd committed. The newspapers at the time, The Guardian, The Foreign Correspondence, they lied about what he was going to jail for. The Guardian said he went to jail as part of an 88 million real money laundering scheme or embezzlement scheme in Petrobras Petroleum Company, which is a straight up lie. It was something they originally tried to charge him with that had absolutely no evidence. The charges were that he had received as a gift an apartment, and the papers called it this luxury apartment and everything. And there was actually this kind of like scummy apartment that apparently his wife was looking for an apartment at one point, and she visited it once, but they never went there. They never owned it. It seems as if now they had offered to give it to them, and they had declined to accept it. And so there was no evidence that he'd ever lived in the apartment, that any reforms had ever taken in the apartment. There was no paper trail showing that he'd ever owned the apartment. the deed of the apartment was still in the name of the construction company. And so, and also on top of that, the time that the prosecutors argued he'd received the apartment was after he had left the presidency. He wasn't a public official, and there's no law against receiving a gift if you're not in politics and not political office in Brazil. Right. So they pulled some legal maneuvering so they could put him on trial in another state, in another city, completely outside of the jurisdiction. All right. And so what happened? It was all part of a joint U.S. Department of Justice, Brazilian public prosecutors operation called Lava Jato. In hindsight, The Intercept published hundreds of hours of social media chats, which showed that the prosecutors and the judge overseeing the investigation were illegally collaborating the entire time to damage Lula's image, to feed slander to the press, you know, to put trumped up charges against them. There is even conversations 2 hours before the final trial date in which the prosecutors are saying, we know we don't have any evidence of him committing anything. Thank God Sergio Moro's the judge. And so he was prosecuted with no jury by this judge who, very bizarrely, the same judge who oversaw the investigation, who got to decide to accept and reject evidence. He rejected 200 witnesses on Lula's defense. You know, he was allowed to rule on his own case, basically. And now, in thanks for removing Lula from the presidential elections in 2018, where Lula was leading with over double the support of Jair Bolsonaro, even after he was in jail, barred from speaking to the press or campaigning, 1 month before the election, he was removed against a legally binding UN Human Rights Committee ruling, because their rulings are legally binding in Brazil. He was removed from the election. And in reward for his hard work getting Lula out of the election, Jair Bolsonaro made this super justice minister position for Sergio Moro, the judge. And he's now in charge of, like, the Brazilian equivalent of the FBI, you know, the justice ministry, the equivalent of the DOJ in Brazil, even though it's been publicized widely through The Intercept that he committed around 60 or 70 felonies during his political persecution of Lula. So, and you know, U.S.-backed investigation, the U.S. government collected. The other thing that this Operation Car Wash Lava Jato operation did was it completely destabilized the Brazilian economy during the lead up to the 2016 coup, so that it would weaken Dilma Rousseff's popular support. So what they did was they, for example, Judge Moro issued an order paralyzing all operations of Brazil's five largest construction and engineering companies, which are all international competitors with, like, Bechtel and Halliburton. They were doing contracts all over Africa and things like that, paralyzed for 6 months. 500,000 workers were immediately laid off, and they say over 1 million indirect layoffs as the direct result of this action, which a study published in BBC Brazil showed caused that year, 2015, 2.8% of Brazil's, like, 3.1% drop in GDP was caused by that. You know, so they kind of crippled the economy before the impeachment process began. And during that process of anti-corruption investigation into Brazil's largest and most strategic industries, like its aviation industry, its shipbuilding industry, petroleum and construction, through cornerstones of Brazil's, like, development strategy. In the process of that, the U.S. Department of Justice collected over $3.2 billion in fines from Brazilian companies. And early last year, they tried to kick $680 million back to the Operation Car Wash team so that they could start a private anti-corruption foundation in Curitiba. And this was blocked by the Supreme Court in Brazil because it's a crime. You know, and also, they were illegally collaborating the whole time. I mean, Brazil has a treaty with the United States for bilateral cooperation and law enforcement that was signed in 1998, which says that any collaboration between Brazilian and American prosecutors and judges and law enforcement officials has to be authorized by the foreign ministry. And so they bypassed this. They were communicating illegally the whole time. And the reason that the foreign affairs ministry has to authorize it is because it's a question of national sovereignty. They have to know what kinds of communications are going on with their law enforcement officials and people in other countries, especially a country like the U.S., which backed the 1964 military coup and has a long history of trying to destabilize things in Brazil. You know, so anyway, I mean, this is a big subject, and I'm actually translating a book right now about lawfare, about Lula's case, that's written by Rafael Valen, who's one of the top legal scholars in Brazil, and two of Lula's defense lawyers, which documents a lot of the history of the DOJ and how it keeps working to expand its powers and work as a political force in foreign countries through the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and stuff. So you're asking me about this. I could go off on this subject for a long time.
I just wanted to add, for anyone that's more interested in the story of Lula, I would recommend, I believe you're friends with him, actually. My pal, Michael Brooks, who I've had on the show a few times, he's done some really great work on Lula's story, as well as Brazil Wire. I'm sure you have a lot of archived content that my listeners can check out. I want to move into the subject of Bolsonaro. I just want to give my commentary here because I've tried to be pretty objective with things, but when it comes to Bolsonaro, I just see a really, there's something really hideous and just slimy about this little man, Bolsonaro. He's just, to me, a complete creep. A lot of people like to compare him to Donald Trump. In some ways, I would say he's even worse than Trump. And I think he's, I don't know if fascist is an overstatement, but he seems pretty monstrous to me.
You know, fascist is not an overstatement at all. He's literally a neo or a sub-fascist. You know, Chomsky created this term sub-fascist in the 70s to describe the Brazilian, the Chilean, and the Argentinian military dictatorships, because they have all the trappings of fascism, all the ideology of fascism, except they're subservient to the United States. So they're sub-fascists. So Bolsonaro is someone who's praised Hitler on TV. You know, he said if he were in Germany, he bragged that his grandfather lost an arm fighting in Hitler's army. And if he were around in Germany at that time, he would have, without a doubt, fought with the Nazis. You know, he's talked about, you know, killing. He said the problem with the Brazilian military dictatorship is they didn't kill enough. They should have killed 30,000 more leftists. So, you know, like one of the historic trappings of fascism is being anti-socialist, anti-labor union, anti-leftist. And that's how he propelled himself into office, as well as being racist and homophobic, especially homophobic. And so I think it's fair to call him a fascist, or a neo-fascist or sub-fascist. That's totally fair. And I would say the difference between him and Trump, you know, Trump has more power. So Trump's probably doing shittier things around the world than Bolsonaro is. But Bolsonaro is kind of like a mean Trump with no sense of humor. You know, it's just all hate. That he's incapable of making a joke. Whenever he tries to make a joke, it's some gay joke or something that nobody laughs at. Even his own government officials. So I would say he's worse because he's literally the product of a neo-fascist military dictatorship. He made his career during the dictatorship. He was a captain during the dictatorship. He supports torture and things like that openly. So I would say you're not exaggerating.
And I also wanted to add, I did not realize until I was prepping for this show that there's a figure, he's very little known, I think, to American audiences, but I've been familiar with him for some time, a man by the name of Olavo de Carvalho. I may be mispronouncing his name. I've been familiar with him.
No, that's fine.
For quite a number of years, and he's sort of considered the ideologue of Bolsonaro, although he rejects that label. And I think he's almost like the Steve Bannon of Brazil and the Bolsonaro regime. Maybe you could talk a little bit about him and also a recent article that appeared in Brazil Wire about Carvalho.
Well, he's a guy like, it's just like, you know, they said Hitler was really into astrology and stuff, right? And so Olavo Carvalho is a former astrology columnist who has no university degree, who considers himself a philosopher, who's lived in Virginia, pretty close to Langley, for like 20 years. He's got no vested interest anymore in Brazil. And he's become this kind of YouTube guru. A lot of young people watch his YouTube videos. They were slickly produced. No one knows where the money came from. But, you know, when Bolsonaro and Sergio Moro, the guy who put Lula in jail, were in Washington recently, the three of them visited the CIA together, CIA headquarters. The first time a Brazilian president and justice minister have made a visit to the CIA headquarters, which is really weird. But anyway, this guy, Carvalho, I think he's friends with Steve Bannon. I mean, when Bolsonaro went up, his first visit after becoming president with his kids and stuff, they went up to D.C. and they had dinner with Steve Bannon and Olavo Carvalho together. And I think they're friends. It's the same ideology. You know, it's this far right, like trying to sow confusion, generating distortion in the media by constantly sending out mixed messages, calling everything fake news that you don't agree with them. It's all straight Bannon. Bannon, I guess, helped in Bolsonaro's campaign even. But the thing about Carvalho is that he's handpicked several of Bolsonaro's top cabinet ministers. So he's actually a really influential guy. And he, including the ridiculous, you know, like foreign affairs minister, the cultural minister was fired. The cultural minister of culture was fired for plagiarizing, like word for word, a speech by Joseph Goebbels in a video he released to the public that was even framed exactly like the Goebbels film, in which he said the exact same thing with the exact same position. Instead of Hitler's photo above him, it was Bolsonaro's photo. And the foreign affairs minister, the education minister who last year made a speech in which he plagiarized Mein Kampf and replaced the Jews with the communists. So he gave this speech where he was saying the communists are at the top of the world financial system and stuff like that. It's just wacky. Like Olavo Carvalho is a flat earther too. He's just
I was unaware of that. I know that he sort of paints himself as one of these, I guess, part of the traditionalist school of philosophy, and he makes himself out to be like a critic of modernity. But I think most philosophers just consider him a joke, and he's really most known for...
He's not a philosopher. He's just not.
No, I agree. Self-styled, self-described philosopher who basically uses his platform to preach his far right-wing ideology and his anti-communist ideas.
Yeah, just hate speech. But the thing that's weird is it seems like he's connected in some way to some kind of U.S. intelligence. You know, like why was he in CIA headquarters with them? You know, he's funded from somewhere. He's been getting funding from somewhere for a long time. You know, because all of this stuff does is it just Lula was not, you know, a radical left wing president, nor was Dilma. They were like Social Democrats, probably aligned. They would be maybe a little bit to the left of Bernie Sanders, but not much. You know, a lot of stuff that they did, which seems to the left of Bernie Sanders, just because Brazil, like most countries in the world, is a lot farther left than the U.S., even when it has conservative presidents. I mean, like even right now, it has a universal public health system and free public universities.
I assume Carvalho, when he says anti-communist, he means anything to the left of someone like Bolsonaro, basically.
Listen, Bolsonaro, following Olavo Carvalho's lead, has labeled the economist the e-communist.
Oh my God. Wow.
He says the economist communist.
I was very interested when I read the article at Brazil Wire, Olavo de Carvalho... Carvalho, the guru of death. Apparently, he is saying coronavirus does not exist, has not killed anyone anywhere in the world. He really does sound like a guru of death. I mean, this has infected more than 300,000 people and killed more than 15,000 people around the world in just a few months' time.
Yeah, and Bolsonaro's following his lead. Bolsonaro's like reading from Malavo's script on TV every night, saying, oh, it's just, on March 10th, Bolsonaro gave a national televised speech quoting Carvalho, like he always does. I mean, he doesn't cite Carvalho's name, but if you see the Carvalho video, then you watch of the day, and then you watch Bolsonaro's speech later, they're very connected. On March 10th, he gave a speech on national television during prime time saying that coronavirus was a media fantasy. It was a hoax. It was fake news. You know, and then it looked like he was backing down a little bit on it. And then last week, he said it again. And he's telling people to ignore the lockdown orders, ignore the quarantine orders that are being made from the governors and the mayors. That Brazilians are strong, they're not weak like the Italians. You know, Brazilians can play in the sewage and not get sick, which is a lie, of course. But just because in the poor neighborhoods they don't have sewage systems, you know, sometimes you see kids playing in sewage. But the sewage-borne illness transmission rates are through the roof in Brazil because of this. He's just talking out of his ass. You know, he's like, oh, we won't get sick. It'll just kill some of the weak. You know, he's saying that as recently as like last night. And so he's becoming more and more isolated.
Is he? It sounds like he's straight up looking at this through a weird sort of social Darwinist lens. Oh, it'll just kill the weak. Who cares about them?
It's neo-Malthusianism, right? It's like Malthus. Yeah. And you know what? Like, he's now being isolated in the international media by the same media organizations that helped bring him to power. The Guardian ran 22 articles normalizing his rise to power during the month before the 2018 elections. They ran an article in which they allowed him to compare himself to Winston Churchill. You know, they
which may be an apt comparison.
Well, yeah, Churchill starved like 3 million people to death in India. So if you look at that, and was connected to the English fascists, so it could be, but that's not the way the Guardian presents Winston Churchill normally, you know. But what was I going to say? So they did all this work, all these media groups that did all this work normalizing Bolsonaro and just smearing Fernando Haddad, comparing him to Hugo Chavez and things like that. He's a mild-mannered university professor with 20 years governmental management experience, former Secretary of Education, Mayor of Sao Paulo, would be much better at handling this coronavirus crisis than Bolsonaro is. All those papers are suddenly, they've kind of like isolated Bolsonaro. Now, I was talking with Jim Narikas from FAIR about this. I'm going to do an article about this in the next couple of days. But basically, it's like a lot of what he's saying about the coronavirus, he's just copying Trump and Boris Johnson. Like he started talking about this herd strategy. Oh, they're doing it in England. And then,
oh, herd immunity.
You know, herd immunity, yeah, herd immunity, and because sometimes I mess up the translation in my head. It's herd immunity, and he's quoting Trump saying that we don't need to do the quarantines and all this stuff, but he's been just like isolated and is being reamed in the international media by the same publications that helped him come to power by spreading lies and slander about the PT party for 5 years, and you know, normalizing his victory as a legitimate democratic process when all evidence points otherwise. So now he's the big boogeyman. But what he's saying is not any different from what the lieutenant governor of Texas said on Fox News, or even Thomas Friedman using more polite euphemisms in his ridiculous column in the New York Times recently about how the economy should be prioritized over human lives, basically. That's what he's saying. And you know what? That's what a large percentage of the international capitalist class supports right now.
Right. There's basically an argument that we need to throw the most vulnerable people in our society, the elderly, into the furnace to be sacrificed to mammon, essentially, just so the market can keep going.
Yeah, just so the banks, you know, and the billionaire class can keep going. There's no, I mean, if there was an actual social contract which guaranteed that everyone had enough to eat, everyone had their own place in that was dignified, you know, everyone could get a job who wanted to work or something like that. If there's some kind of social contract in place. For example, remember the nuclear disaster in Japan recently, where a bunch of elderly volunteered to go in and get exposed to the radiation to help stop the disaster. Because they're part of a society that has like a social contract where people take care of each other and there's solidarity. But the U.S. doesn't have that. It's already throwing a large portion of the population under the bus. 30 million people don't have health insurance at all. You know, so why should anyone make a fucking sacrifice for this system? Much less so the elderly who've been busting their asses an entire life. You know, a lot of them can't even retire. My mom can't retire because of her student loan payments. She's 73. She's still got student loan payments deducted from her Social Security. And they're supposed to sacrifice themselves to keep this system running. It's ridiculous. But that's basically what, you know, Bolsonaro is saying about Brazil. You know, some people are going to die. It's okay. You know, it's just like the flu. And so it's funny that he's being singled out because I think it's a way that the U.S. media can say, well, anything, anywhere but here. It's kind of like deflecting the issue from Americans and putting it all on Bolsonaro, which politically, you know, could be useful for us right now. I mean, hopefully this will contribute to Bolsonaro getting pushed out of office somehow. But it's not, I really question the motives of why the American media is doing this right now. You have people like Brian Winter, former Brazil Reuters chief, editor of America's Quarterly, which is connected to the ASCOA Rockefeller-funded think tank that's been involved in every coup in Latin America since the Pinochet in Chile. You know, so they brought Bolsonaro up during his campaign tour to speak in Washington, and he spent a week visiting the Bolsonaro family, writing all these articles, normalizing Bolsonaro, you know, saying, oh, he's tough on crime because when he was a kid, he used to hide under the table when he heard gunshots in his hometown, like this poor, vulnerable Bolsonaro guy. He's now like the go-to guy for The Guardian and The New York Times and Atlantic Magazine for talking about both for criticizing Bolsonaro. You know, he's one of the people who normalized it. You see, not just him, but like the Wilson Center and, you know, all these people who are involved, you know, why are they suddenly so anti-Bolsonaro?
Out of curiosity, is there anyone in Brazil that is buying this swinish little man, Bolsonaro's, just utter swill that he's pushing on the public?
Yeah, he's got, okay, and this is the thing that's dangerous about him. He's got 15% of the nation as fanatical supporters, and another 15% generally support him. So his popularity rates, since the month after he took office, they've been hovering around the 30% level. But this 15% are fanatical supporters. And this is something that the Brazilian bourgeoisie was not counting on, because the traditional kind of like center-right bourgeoisie supported him. The media and all this supported him coming to office because they were so terrified that Fernando Haddad would win and that they'd deprivatize a lot of the privatizations and he'd block the retirement pension reforms and all these neoliberal austerity cuts that they supported. You know, so they supported Bolsonaro coming to power, much like the German bourgeoisie supported Hitler coming to power, thinking, well, he's a clown, but he's harmless. We'll remove him from office when he's no longer useful for us. And this is what the Brazilian bourgeoisie did with Bolsonaro. The problem that the Germans didn't take into account was that Hitler had a strong base level of fanatical supporters. Bolsonaro does too, but I think the difference is that in Hitler's case, it might have been like 50% of the population or 60% that was fanatically supporting Nazism. In Brazil, it's like 15%. But there's still this issue of this base that are coming out onto the streets, having protests now to shut down Congress, to shut down the Supreme Court, to bring back a dictatorship.
And I believe you have an article at Brazil Wire basically pointing out that a lot of elderly evangelicals and the rich within Brazil are falling for these lies that Bolsonaro is telling about coronavirus and that it's very dangerous.
It is dangerous. I mean, there's people having like coronavirus parties in together and making jokes about how they're all passing coronavirus to each other. So this 15% of core supporters, they're just pretending that coronavirus doesn't exist as a joke. They're just all on the streets now. And then there's other people, a lot of people who have to be out on the streets all day because they might be street vendors or they have to go to work in some way or another, even though a lot of the stuff's closed. And so it's a pretty dangerous situation. And like Brian Winter in this Atlantic article that came out recently, as always, when he criticizes Bolsonaro, he always gives these half-handed, under-the-table compliments back to Bolsonaro. So he said that he thinks Bolsonaro is worried about street vendors. And that's why, and people who work in the informal sector of the economy, that they won't be able to eat if a quarantine order comes in. It's just utter rubbish, because Bolsonaro tried to block legislation that just passed Congress that was introduced by the PT and even some center-right parties to guarantee basic universal income for anyone who was employed in the informal sector, which is like, I don't know, maybe 20, 30% of the workforce, so that they would receive 1.2 minimum wages per month per family until the crisis ends, until the quarantine lockdowns end. And he tried to block that. So he's obviously not telling people to come out on the street because he's worried about the street vendors. Obviously not. He's doing this because of the capitalists who finance his campaign, who back him up. The president of Banco do Brasil, which is the biggest bank in Latin America, he endorsed Bolsonaro's order to end the quarantines and lockdowns. You know, and I'm sure there's all kinds of international banks and things like that that are 100% behind Bolsonaro right now on this. And the U.S., the CIA is backing him. The U.S., not just the CIA, but U.S., the Trump administration, U.S. intelligence services, public and privatized, whatever, they all seem to be backing him. So as China turns on him and as the bourgeoisie turns on him, he's becoming more and more isolated. The media is turning on him, but he still feels like he's backed by the U.S.
Does he still have the support of the military within Brazil? I've heard rumblings of even the military being very angry with him.
He had a meeting with the military yesterday in which he broke down in tears, which is really lame for a fascist to do. You know, like when guys on the left are supposed to like break down in tears during these community meetings and stuff, talking about, you know, whatever. But to have a fascist cry in front of a bunch of military generals within the machisto culture, that's a pretty big, you know, faux pas, I would think, a fascist faux pas. But basically, the military is divided. He's got support from some of the military, and there's some of the military don't support him. The vice president doesn't support him on everything. The vice president's always contradicting him. Like when Bolsonaro's idiot son tweeted out that China had developed the coronavirus in a laboratory to kill capitalists 2 weeks ago, the Chinese government was furious. And the vice president, General Moran, you know, immediately said, look, this guy's not part of our government. He's a congressman. He's not a, you know, he's not a part of the executive branch of the government. His comments don't reflect anything. And he's just a little banana and you shouldn't pay any attention to him. And so we see even some rumblings among his own cabinet and vice president who are generals. He's got like 16 generals in cabinet positions right now, which is more than any military dictator ever had during the dictatorship. But it's hard to say, you know, because sometimes people put faith in that maybe the military is going to straighten this out and take him out and get rid of Bolsonaro. At the same time, they're pretty disappointing on a lot of things, you know. I don't think we can put that much faith in them at this point. But from what I understand, he's got a lot more support from different state military police forces than the actual military itself. The support in the military leadership is divided. Go ahead.
I was going to say, my understanding is as well that the governors within Brazil are also very upset with Bolsonaro. I believe the governor of Sao Paulo, which is the most populous and economically important, one of the most populous and economically important states within Brazil, basically told the 44 million citizens within Sao Paulo, do not follow the guidance of the president. I understand that Bolsonaro has threatened to sack his health minister for coronavirus criticisms. It seems like everything is falling apart for this vampiric little man.
It does, and that's true about the governors. And Sao Paulo is the most important and biggest state. It's like the California of Brazil. You know, but and Doria ran for governor and won, the governor of Sao Paulo, on Bolsonaro's coattails. He made t-shirts that said Bolsa Doria. And he's another fucking Trump wannabe. You know, he was the star of Trump's apprentice show in Brazil. So he's not a leftist at all. So he's taken out commercials that are running on the TV channel saying don't pay any attention to Bolsonaro. One of the commercials says, why is Bolsonaro the only person in the world saying that you shouldn't obey the quarantines? The World Health Organization recommends it. Even Trump's recommending it. Boris Johnson's recommending it. Why is Bolsonaro the only guy? You know, because Bolsonaro took out, he started an advertising campaign a few days ago telling Brazilians to ignore quarantine and go back to work and to reopen the schools. And so a Supreme Court minister issued an injunction to remove Bolsonaro from office for 180 days. For disobeying World Health Organization guidelines during a pandemic, which is a crime in Brazil. The problem is this, the Attorney General is a friend of Bolsonaro's. It's the Attorney General. The Supreme Court justice issued the injunction to the Attorney General's office, and they're just sitting on it right now. But there's more and more pressure against him. You know, and you're absolutely right about the governors. And one thing that's really interesting about the governors, too, is that in northeastern Brazil, where the Guardian's Tom Phillips was traveling around in October 2018 during the election period, and he wrote in the Guardian tweeted out that he couldn't find one person who supported Fernando Haddad in the Northeast, when in fact Haddad got 70% of the vote in the Northeast compared to 30% for Bolsonaro. Every governor except one state in the Northeast is left wing. And they've all banded together and created their own coronavirus contention plan and reached out to the Chinese government for support, and the Chinese government's going to start directly supporting those states. So in addition to 25 of 27 states that are completely ignoring Bolsonaro's, you know, call to end the quarantines, there's 8 states in the Northeast that are, you know, being strengthened by China right now, and that are just creating their own coronavirus plan. And, you know, some of them are doing a really good job. I interviewed one of the top officials of Maranhão State Public Health Department today. It just came out on Brazil Wire. And, you know, their governor is from the Communist Party. It's the only communist governor in Brazil. Like, they set up a public testing center when they only had 2 confirmed cases of coronavirus in the state. They'd already set up the testing center, and they've set up sanitary roadblocks on all the highways coming into the state where they take everyone's temperature, and they've got temperature reading stations at the airports and stuff. They're expanding their ICU units, even though they've only got 50 confirmed cases in the state right now. So we see that despite Bolsonaro, there's a lot of really good work being done right now to try and fight this pandemic, you know, and it's something that's being lost in the international media. Because I see this trope starting up that, like, Bolsonaro is a maniac. Brazil's going to crash and burn. It's a failed state. They're not doing anything. What about the favelas? Do they even know how to stop a disease from transferring in the favelas? When in actuality, you know, Brazil has a pretty good public health system, which during the last big world pandemic, which was HIV/AIDS, developed a much, much, much better program than the United States, limited AIDS transmission to about a quarter per capita of the amount of transmission that happened in the U.S., broke international antiretroviral patent laws so that they could provide free antiretroviral medication to all HIV patients in the country.
Well, I think it's also worth noting, my understanding is that 60% of the population in Brazil is staying home. They're not listening to Bolsonaro. As far as I understand it, a majority of the population is saying, screw this.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, it's just like, there are these 15% of the population is following Bolsonaro. And there's two very remote states with very low populations, Rondônia and Roraima, in the Amazon region, that have zero cases of confirmed coronavirus at this point, that haven't started quarantine or lockdowns yet or anything. You know, most people in the country are, I mean, and you know, the schools and all the commerce is shut down almost everywhere too. So there's, even if people did go outside, there's not much they can do. The bars are closed. So yeah, I mean, in a way, all right. So the U.S. State Department issued this letter that I got in my emails calling all Americans living in Brazil to move back to the U.S. And I chose not to because I honestly think Brazil is going to do a better job with the coronavirus crisis than the U.S. is. And at least, you know, there's a public health system here. I'm not going to run up any medical bills if I go up there. You know, and I trust, like, there's this institute called Fiocruz. It's a branch of the public health system. It was founded 120 years ago to fight a pandemic that was going on in Rio de Janeiro's favelas. They are the ones who discovered Chagas disease in 1908. They have a really long history of fighting tropical pandemics. They're leaders in the world fight against Zika virus and dengue fever and stuff like that. They have their operating budget, despite the cuts and everything, still have like a $1 billion operating budget. They produce their own medication and vaccines, you know? Like the U.S. doesn't have a public health institution that makes its own medicine for free distribution, you know. And I mean, they're doing really phenomenal work. All the directors of Fiocruz are women, you know. They operate in like every state in the union, and they're working on developing like rapid tests that can give results in 5 minutes right now, and testing all the medications. And they've set up field hospitals. And they're working on strategies to prevent transmission in the favelas. And they have 120 years of experience of that, you know, which American health officials don't have. So, I mean, I work in TV production sometimes with foreign TV crews. And I was an assistant producer of this BBC Panorama episode about the Zika virus crisis in 2016 with Jane Corbin. We spent a couple of weeks up in Pernambuco, and there was a guy from the CDC down there working in the crisis. He said, look, don't interview me. Interview these women from Fiocruz Institute. They're doing the best work on this right now. You know, so, and they have a lot of respect in the WHO. You know, a lot of the top officials, whenever a Brazilian you see in a top position in the World Health Organization, they usually come out of Fiocruz. You know, so, I mean, it's not like, and, you know, the shit is hitting the fan here in Sao Paulo, right? Sao Paulo has 6 million first, second, or third generation Italians living in it, and constant air traffic between Italy and Sao Paulo, and before the lockdown started, and also a growing Chinese population and more commerce and stuff. So Sao Paulo is really like ground zero, and I'm a little bit scared about how bad it's going to get here. But I see that the center right wing mayor and the center right wing governor are putting up like 3,000 ICU units in field hospitals. They're building in soccer stadiums and the convention center. And like, it hasn't gotten to the point yet. I feel like even in, you know, even down here with these kind of like center right people in charge of government, I feel like they started earlier in the transmission process of the virus than New York did. So I'm just hoping that we don't get hit as bad as New York, you know?
If I could, I just wanted to note, yeah. So we're recording this on April 1st, and you can correct me on any of these numbers. I want to throw them out real quick. My understanding is Brazil has 42 new deaths from coronavirus, bringing the total number of deaths to 201. I believe the number of confirmed cases has increased by 25% and has reached 5,717 confirmed cases. Are those numbers correct? How bad is it going to get?
Well, that's 25% overnight. So that's not very comforting. But once again, with Theo Cruz, the Margaret Dal Colmo, who's the head of pneumonology, lung doctor. Sorry, she's the head pulmonologist at Theo Cruz. She has said that due to Theo Cruz is monitoring all cases of ICU internations for acute and severe respiratory infections in Brazil, regardless of coronavirus. And they noticed a spike last week in which the numbers were 10 times higher than normal and none of those people being tested, right? So they estimate that the actual numbers are already 10 times higher than the official numbers, just a lack of testing. So like China's sending 5 million test kits here. There's some Brazilian scientists have invented a new kind of test kit that gives a result in 5 minutes, and they're supposed to have 1.3 million of them ready by May 1st. So they're going to start doing more testing, and that's going to show probably numbers going through the roof. But even so, 5,700 cases times 10 in a country of 215 million people, right now that's still a lot lower than New York than the United States or something like that. But at the rate it's growing is what's concerning, I think, And then we still have to see if there are any climactic characteristics. They say that, Theo Cruz people say the virus is already mutating here. We have to see if there's any peculiar characteristics because of the weather. That hot weather. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, do you mean like literally mutating? I know the general consensus has been that we don't know if it'll mutate, and it sounds unlikely, but you're saying like an actual mutation?
This is what Theo Cruz, director of their public health school, is saying. It's already mutated.
That's scary. Here. Yeah.
Maybe it's mutating for the better, though, Although what she said is that most hospital internations so far have been men between, going on respirators have been men between 47 and 50, even though most of the deaths are people over 70. There's a lot more younger people going in with really bad respiratory problems here. But, there's this theory that hot weather will slow down the transmission of the virus, which is what I interviewed this guy from Maranhão State Health Department about today. Because their average year-round temperature is like between 30 and 32 Celsius in that state. And he says he doesn't see any connection between hot weather and slowing down the transmission. And also there's no scientific studies showing that yet. So it's just a rumor. It would be nice if that would turn out to be the case. Or maybe, there's the other thing is like asymptomatic transmission. There's that new study in Lancet that says 25% of the cases seem to be completely asymptomatic, which just brings down the mortality rate. But it's kind of, whatever. Oh, I'm in the same boat as you guys. I mean, I'm sure you're very worried about what's happening in the U.S. with us, too. I think there's a lot of reasons to be worried. Yeah. It's kind of nervous. I'm just coming off pneumonia from February. I hope it was coronavirus, because if it wasn't, I'm in the high risk group here.
Before we let you go, Brian, I wanted to kick it over to my co-host, Casey. I feel like I haven't given him proper time to sort of pick your brain. So, Casey, if you want to ask Brian anything or add some commentary in, Brian, if you have some time to field a question or two,
sure,
for my co-host.
I'm just literally lounging around in quarantine. We've got all the time in the world.
Casey, would you like to say anything?
Yeah, I feel pretty similarly. I got all the time in the world just lounging around in a bathrobe, so might as well spend it doing something. But this whole episode kind of reinforces this idea that to try to abstract away from Brazil and COVID-19 in particular, this seems like a developing proxy situation between the United States and the People's Republic of China. And it's finding its most salient expression in these seeming deepening divides. and Brazil. So I guess I wanted to ask both that and in light of we already have one country where the prime minister, the leader, is the executive, is ruling by decree. That's Hungary. So do you think that Brazil or that Bolsonaro would try to pursue a similar route, since a bunch of these institutions seem to be working against him? And if that were to happen, or even if it doesn't happen, what do you think is, do you see these tensions being relieved when the COVID-19 pandemic lifts, or do you think this will build upon itself to a breaking point at some indeterminate point in the future?
I mean, okay, it's two questions, but like the second question, I think it's really this whole coronavirus thing is just this giant X factor. I can't make any prediction about how this is going to turn out. Regarding Bolsonaro, like trying to rule by decree, one thing that's really nice about the Brazilian political system is their checks and balances on the decrees. So some of his decrees have been blocked by judges. I mean, he started this ad campaign, go back out onto the streets and through decree, and a judge has already blocked it, you know, for putting if it's something that puts the public in danger, the decrees can be blocked. So I don't think he has the same powers that scumbag in Hungary has. But, you know, you never know. Like, I feel like Brazil could go either way right now. Either there could be this lockdown in which the military helps Bolsonaro consolidate his power, maybe even through shutting down Congress and the Supreme Court. Or it's going to go the other way and he's going to be forced out of office, impeached. He might die in a car accident or something. If the military decides they don't want him anymore, they've got a lot of ways to get rid of him. So
he seems pretty scared now, Bolsonaro, in some ways. Good. I mean, you said he was crying.
I'm glad.
Right.
Yeah. He should be crying. It's such an incredible fuck-up he's just done. But the first question about China, yeah, I mean, I don't know if you guys know Pepe Escobar, Brazilian journalist who's...
I know Pepe,
like him, but sometimes he goes a little bit all over the top with some of his analysis.
I think he's been saying...
Go on. Well, he's been saying for a while now that there's this full-spectrum war going on between the U.S. and China. That's not being done with conventional weaponry, but it's being done with everything else. And that Brazil is the front lines. You know, China has surpassed the U.S. as Brazil's most important trade partner. You know, it's the second biggest economy in the Americas, you know, and the second biggest country in population. They used to say, things have changed a little bit, but they used to say you could divide the economy of Latin America into four equal parts, São Paulo State, the rest of Brazil, Mexico, and the rest of Latin America. So people don't realize how important it is economically for this region. And it's really like the front lines right now of this ideological battle between ideological and economic and social and everything between China and the U.S. And so the fact that China's turning on Bolsonaro is a pretty big deal. You know, so I don't know. I mean, we even see like leftist or ostensibly leftist publications from the U.S. opening shop in Brazil in the last 2 years and like publishing all this really cool stuff about the left and this and that, but then slipping in all of this anti-China propaganda. It's really weird. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know how it's going to play out, but I have a feeling that at this moment, China has the upper hand against the U.S. in the region. And they're helping Russia block the U.S. from overthrowing the government in Venezuela. And they lost Bolivia, but Bolivia's like crashing and burning. I think that Morales and the socialists are going to take Bolivia back. I don't know about the rest. Chile, you know, Chile demonstrated the total failure of neoliberalism like 6 months before coronavirus kicked in and showed the rest of the world to it. So the region was really getting into upheaval everywhere before this even started. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. You know, when the crisis ends, if the crisis ends, how long it's going to take, I don't know.
It was I was going to say it was interesting you mentioned Pepe Escobar. I agree with some of his analysis, but I was a bit shocked by his... He wrote an article recently talking about coronavirus as a bioweapon, and I'm not willing to go that far, so I sort of get what you say when you say he can go over the top, but a lot of his analysis is still worth reading nonetheless.
I was on a Brazilian web TV panel discussion with him, and he compared me to Dennis Hopper, so I can't really badmouth him that much. He's like, you remind me of Dennis Hopper, that American guy. He's like, I hope you're not talking about Blue Velvet Dennis Hopper.
Casey, were you going to chip in something there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think you're kind of hitting the nail on the head, not just for Brazil or the United States, but across most of the developed and developing world, that this feels like a fork in the road, and anything can happen in the next 6 months in any manner of ways. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, thanks for asking questions.
I just wanted to pitch in one more thing. I had to ask, one of the things I've been really focused on that I don't hear as many people talking about, at least in the U.S. media, is there's been a lot of incidents of panic fleeing, especially really rich areas. People are panic fleeing from these rich areas, and a lot of the people fleeing are probably asymptomatic carriers, and as a result are spreading the virus. And it's something that has really gotten me angry in regards to the class aspects of all of this. Is there any of that type of panic fleeing happening in Brazil?
Well, I know some people who, like, they have vacation homes or in the mountains or on the beach, and they, you know, they started trying to relocate there. The governor shut down the highway to the beaches from São Paulo. São Paulo is on this, like, 2,500 foot high plateau, 30 miles from the beaches, and they just shut down access. They're only letting residents down there. So that cut off some of it, and the air travel's been cut. You know, I was actually thinking of panic fleeing myself. You know, I had a friend offer me a house. I would have gone up to the Northeast and quarantined for 14 days, but there's really no way of getting anywhere anymore. So I think a lot of the panic fleeing is been cut off, and I think it's another thing that, you know, they're doing right here. I think it's good, but I don't think in general Brazilian people don't worry as much as Americans about this stuff. I mean, like, I could go out right now if I wanted and buy as many rolls of toilet paper as I wanted. You know, Brazilian people know that when you run out of toilet paper, you use newspaper. If you don't have a newspaper, you wash your ass. It's not the end of the world. It's not like the first thing you would go out and hoard if you think the end of the world's coming or something. So I don't think it's as much panic fleeing as there is in New York, for example.
Well, the reason I ask is my understanding is that in Italy, a large reason for it getting so bad is in part because everyone just moved so quickly, and a lot of people that were asymptomatic didn't realize they had it, and then it spread that way. So I worry that a lot of people didn't realize that when this first started becoming a bigger and bigger issue. I can understand people fleeing as long as they're doing the 14-day quarantine, but if people aren't doing that, I mean, to me, it's like all hell breaking loose.
Yeah, I think that by the time people started kind of like panicking and thinking about fleeing, all the transport routes were cut off down here. You know? I mean, I know you can get around inside the state of São Paulo, but they have like checkpoints at all the state boundaries and stuff. So I don't think it's going to be as big a problem. I know that in northern Italy, a lot of the labor force and the lower echelon jobs and stuff are southern Italians. You know, and I think a lot of them went back to their families in the south when the shit started hitting the fan. We have a situation similar in São Paulo in that a lot of the labor force is from northeastern Brazil, but it's so far away. It's not like Italy where it's like a 2-hour train ride or something. I mean, if you took the bus from São Paulo to the northeast, it would be like to São Luís, where I used to live, is 55-hour bus ride. So, and it's expensive, you know, so, and the plane traffic is cut off, and I think buses are cut off now too. So it's not logistically as easy as what happened in Italy.
Well, Brian, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. I want to give you a chance to promote Brazil Wire and your work in general. But before we do that, I always try to end on a positive note, as I've been telling a lot of guests recently. That's very, very hard to do. I don't know if there's a positive note. I'm hoping that Bolsonaro's reign ends in tears for him. I don't know if we can count on that, but I'm hoping for it. But is there any type of positive silver lining or light at the end of the tunnel at the very least in all of this?
Yeah, I think that what's happening is amazing for the environment. I mean, I think that this whole crisis might buy us a couple more years' time before total global climactic collapse or whatever. Because, I mean, like, the air is cleaner than it's ever been in the 7 years I've lived in São Paulo. So I think that maybe it's a good time to start pushing. Everyone's just sitting around in quarantine anyway. Start picking up in the environmental fight and seeing what's changed in terms of pollution after all of this, and what adjustments can we make to keep the carbon emissions lower.
And I want to note too, I believe Brazil has been really at the center of the environmental crisis, because you have Bolsonaro just saying, you know, let's destroy the rainforests, essentially, as far as I understand it.
Yeah, that's another ugly battle going on. And it's not letting up. I've got friends. I covered the last year's fire crisis in Rondônia for Telesur, and I made some friends up there, and they're telling me it's going to be even worse this year, unless all the loggers die of coronavirus. Yeah, that would be a positive thing.
Well, hey, Brian Mir, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. Real quick, if you could, how can my listeners keep up with your work?
Yeah, www.brazilwire.com. And they don't transmit Telesur English on American cable TV, but you can watch it on the website or on its Facebook page. Follow Telesur English on Twitter. It was created by Hugo Chavez to be a socialist alternative to CNN. It's a 24-hour news station, and it's funded by the governments of Cuba, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Uruguay right now, probably Argentina rejoining shortly as well.
Well, Brian, thank you for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you found our conversation with Brian Mir of the Brazil Wire to be informative. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon, patreon.com/ParallaxViews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.